to another opening, another show, a musical theatre podcast, brought to you by the Gawler Broadcasting Association here on Kaurna land in Gawler, South Australia. What was behind door number three, Jane?
Behind door number three, I'm delighted to say we had ragtime.
Ragtime! Not that that was singing from the show at all.
They were random notes.
Yes.
Certainly in my case. I haven't seen the show. So.
Well, listener who has at least listened to the most famous song from that, which is ingeniously titled Ragtime.
Love it.
We'll know that the ending of the song is people singing ragtime held like I did, followed by other people singing ragtime just like Jane did.
Look at us inadvertently recreating the show.
But not breaching copyright.
Not breaching copyright.
No, and as we like to do, we inform you that we don't have the music from the show intertwined in our podcast, as that attracts licensing fees. We do, however, have a Spotify playlist that we've created, hopefully showing the best bits and sometimes quirky recordings of numbers from the show.
Quirky recordings is a very diplomatic way to say it, Jane. I love it.
Well, when I was putting together the $1,000 one, there were some very interesting versions to listen to, including I Love You, A Bushel and a Peck, done by the VeggieTales, which is a Christian children's animation series. Usually you learn about God through cute music, but this time a broccoli or something was singing I Love You, A Bushel and a Peck. Actually, I think it might have been a chicken, which makes sense.
Does it, though? Does it really?
A bushel and a peck.
Okay, fabulous. No singing vegetables. I love it.
Yeah.
Great. Good.
So get over to Spotify. See what I have found on the World Wide Web for you to enjoy in ragtime. I don't think there's anything remotely funny in the ragtime score. This is a big, epic musical. And there are some light-hearted moments, but nothing that screams like Bush on a Peck.
A singing chicken or a singing broccoli.
Indeed. Sure. Ragtime is based on the epic novel of the same name by E.L. Doctorow, himself a child of immigrant Jewish family at the turn of the last century. The Canadian theatrical producer Garth Drabinsky secured, eventually, the permission to musicalise Doctorow's story.
Eventually?
Yes. He approached Brian Stokes Mitchell, who was the original Coal House, when he was in Kiss of the Spider Woman, which was about 2 years prior, and said, I'm working on a thing, but I can't tell you what it is, but I want you to have the lead part. And every few months he'd ring him up and go, I'm still working on that thing and I still can't tell you what it is. And that is because Doctorow did not enjoy the film adaptation, which came out in the late 70s, early 80s, where they reconstructed the story, added in characters who weren't there, and really didn't follow the gist of what he was getting. We would have to ask Milos Forman what he thought he was doing. But E.L. Doctorow was not happy with that. So now you can understand why it took a long time for Drabinsky to get him to agree to make it a musical. He also said, I don't really like musicals. Guys and Dolls is okay. Which, of course, we know Guys and Dolls is more than okay.
Do you know Guys and Dolls?
And at least that's
great.
His reference for a musical.
Not bad.
So he had a lot of cajoling to do. One other thing that Garth Drabinsky did was do the show at the Ford Center for the Performing Arts. And there's a lot about the Ford Motor Company and All Hail Mr. Ford in this show.
Interesting. Yes, there is.
Yes. And when it moved from Toronto to New York, the producer bought two adjoining theaters that were out of use, probably because they had small houses and small stages, and made it this massive thing that could hold this huge show and renamed it the Ford Theatre.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yes, if you want someone on board, use their name.
But one thing about Garth Drabinsky is he was devoted to this work. He was absolutely myopic, would have nothing but the best. He and Doctorow actually auditioned the writing teams.
Wow.
So instead of being a composer and lyricist together saying, oh, have you read that book? Or have you ever wanted to do a musical about a girl who bakes pies and it changes everybody's life? Oh, yes, let's get that started. Let's approach producers to put on the show.
Sure.
This way round, the writing teams were auditioned. They were all commissioned to do four songs for the show.
Right.
I'm going to say Ahrens and Flaherty because that's actually how you should pronounce their names. They say Flaherty and Ahrens. Ahrens and Flaherty. because my brain can't do it, did the best audition, because three of the four numbers are still in the show that they wrote for the audition. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So that indicates that they were on the same wavelength.
Absolutely. If your audition piece stays in.
So all four of them seem to be very simpatico. Drabinski being so enthusiastic sometimes was a little aggressive in his approach when people didn't give him 100% marvellousness.
Right.
And I don't have the quote with me, but the musical director from the original has written a book, and the opening is about the conflicting personalities. Oh. But they all love it. They all say that was the best thing that happened in their life. I don't know about Mr. Drabinski, because he actually lost money and went bankrupt because he made this mega show. Cost $10 million in the 80s.
Yeah, it is a mega show.
It absolutely has 50 people on stage and 38 people in the orchestra. A big show these days has 22 people on stage.
Sure.
And a 28-piece orchestra. Those costs. And it's imagistic set, but I think still quite an expensive set. And I think there's all kinds of hydraulics and turntables.
Yeah, that'll do it every time.
And building a theatre really purposely for this.
Sure.
He might not say it was the best time of his life, but artistically he probably would. In 1975, the novel was written, and it's historical fiction in the way that Forrest Gump is, that we're following characters invented by the writer, but it is interspersed with real people. Like, Forrest didn't actually meet JFK because he...
What?
Forrest is fictional. In this show, Emma Goldman, who was a union leader, Henry Ford, the car guy, J.P. Morgan, the millionaire and banker, Evelyn Nesbitt, who is a music hall star but had lots of other things going on, and Harry Houdini are all in this show, as well as this large cast of fictional characters. Jane S. will talk about that when she does the synopsis.
I certainly will.
It first opened in Toronto in 1996, and they kept that cast. All the leads from the Toronto tryout ended up transferring to Broadway, which is really rare.
Wow.
And again, it was from that producer mainly, saying, I want this person, and securing them.
Right.
So he obviously saw in his head
what he wanted.
They got Terrence McNally, who had written the book of Kiss of the Spider Woman, to do the book of this. Terrence McNally also has written many, many plays. He's really good at adaptation, as well as in his own original work. Frank Galati was the director, and he credits Graziella Daniele with a lot of his work, because she was a choreographer, but there's actually not considered a dance show.
Right.
There's some folk dancing done by some Jewish people, but it's all the kind of dancing that a regular musical theatre person would be able to do.
Sure.
It's not a show where you hire dancers. As it's essentially sung through, as most musicals post-1980 are, she was responsible for moving all of those people on stage in an artful and dramatic way.
Interesting.
And that's a lot of the director's job often.
Absolutely. In a stage play, the director's moving the bodies around.
Mm.
But you're right, in a musical, the choreographer is moving those bodies around like a director otherwise would.
And there's a very famous scene, which I think we'll talk about with our guest later, where the choreography is stunning, but it's actually walking. It's not dance.
What?
Yeah. So, brilliant brain. So they premiered it in Los Angeles.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
The barren wasteland.
It's odd to choose Los Angeles to me when it's a New York story, and New York has... It's not like New York is devoid of theatres.
That's right.
Okay, Los Angeles, sure, why not? Great.
Then it arrived on Broadway in January the 18th, 1998, christening the brand new Ford Center for the Performing Arts.
Da, da, da.
The original cast included Brian Stokes Mitchell as Coldhouse Walker Jr., Audra McDonald as Sarah, Maren Mazie as Mother, Peter Friedman as Tata, and Judy Kaye as Emma Goldman. And a tidbit trivia for younger persons, actually really only like 10 years younger than me, Leah Michelle of Glee.
Oh, yes.
Was the little girl.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why she was so amazing when she was being a teenager, because she'd been on Broadway when she was 8.
Right.
And then she was in Spring Awakening too, before Glee.
Okay.
As a teenager.
So she had real pedigree before even coming onto the Glee set. Mm. Interesting.
Yes.
Love it.
And I think there are probably lots of other emerging young people out of every version of Ragtime, because we had the boy and we have the little girl.
Correct.
So they've probably all gone on to marvellous things. It was nominated for 14 Tonys and only got 4 because it was the same year as The Lion King.
Oh, well, well done for just getting 4.
I know. Audra McDonald as Sarah got the Best Featured Actress. And unfortunately, because of this structure of the three families having stories,
which I will talk about shortly,
and they're all leads, they didn't get called Best Actor in a musical. They were all featured.
Because there's no one lead male, one lead female, everyone support. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of equality in terms of who is leading the show.
Yes, and Sarah, who is, she's not mute, but she refuses really to speak to people.
Yes.
Now, this is a hard role in a musical to write for and to play.
To be the quiet one in a musical, yeah.
Lynn Ahrens said in an interview I was watching, they had her sing a number.
Right.
But it was a duet with Cole House because that felt right. You know, once she was in love and connecting with someone, she would be singing.
Yes.
But at the beginning, the most dramatic and incredibly intense thing happens to this woman. And they said to each other, we've got Audra McDonald.
Yes.
Good Lord. We need to have her expressing this with her marvellous voice. Mm. And it is such a song.
Yes.
It's also a song written for her because I have heard other people sing it, and it just doesn't have that same quality.
It's her song.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right now, Ragtime is on again in New York.
Right.
So I'm getting lots of ads in my social media about Ragtime without even having looked up Ragtime.
Wow, who would have thought your phone was listening? That's crazy. Yeah.
Oh, well, actually, I do know my phone is listening. But I keep saying Coleman instead of Colehouse. And in my head, I am picturing Coleman Domingo playing Colehouse. He can sing, but it's more of a Nat King Cole kind of thing. So I don't know if he'd ever be cast as Colehouse.
Right.
He's also older than I am, so it might just not have been his time.
Sure.
But I think that has been on my mind since Thursday night. It just popped into my head that I kept saying Coleman. And then I thought, oh, yes. I never looked it up. And this morning, I went on my social media of choice, and there was a clip of him singing a Nat King Cole song on Stephen Colbert.
No.
So that's just spooky.
How funny.
Not because I was looking anything up. That's amazing. I haven't got in front of me the list of all the Tonys, and there were nominations for the design. Costumes are just amazing.
Yeah.
But also how to turn, basically it's a bunch of stairs and lifts into all the different locations that this epic novel needs.
It does travel around, absolutely.
They're up against Julie Taymor's Lion King.
Yeah.
Those costumes were so innovative. Innovative now, even.
Absolutely. I mean, Lion King, as a story, it's all generations. It's all people. It's
so amazing. It had already reached the population of the world via Disney.
The movie, for sure.
So, but artistically, that change, that variant into the Broadway show really took everybody by surprise. The snobbish voting people probably were really amazed and went, oh, yes.
You know what? We have to give it to them.
Yeah.
Even though we didn't think we would, we just love those. Yeah.
It's a bit like the Glenn Close Oscar thing. She always does a marvellous performance. Yes. The same year that Meryl does a marvellous performance.
Sure. In Meryl's defence, though, she does a lot of marvellous performances over many years.
Yes.
So it'd be hard-pressed to find a year that you could turn up and she wasn't a contender.
Yeah. If only Glenn had done a fabulous movie when Mamma Mia came out.
Oh, the one year she had a chance.
Oh. We love Meryl. No shade on Meryl.
Of course. Mamma Mia might be behind an upcoming door, and I'm certainly not slamming Mamma Mia. Don't hear it that way, please.
Ragtime is a concept. It all comes from the new music of the turn of the 20th century.
Yes.
The ragtime is the precursor to jazz.
Yep.
Mainly played by the African-American community and then became popular with the wider community.
Yeah.
And it is uniquely American. It's really the first genre that you could say is American. Because the folk music before that was really British Isles folk music.
Yeah.
Might have been written in America, but still in that style. So ragtime, with its unique syncopation.
Yes.
Everything is slightly off kilter.
Yep.
And that is what is permeating through this book and then this musical.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed hearing Stephen Flaherty talking about how he came at this from a music perspective, much more than can you please supply music to my lyrics and my book.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. So I think he was the driving force course in going for the audition for this show, because he could hear in his head how that was going to work dramatically.
Right. Okay.
If you listen to nothing else, just listen to the prologue where they are explaining what's going to happen. They use a very interesting tool, and I think this is Terence McNally's doing, of actually narrating about oneself.
Yes.
So they stand out from the group and they talk or sing about their lives to the audience. The lyrics are really important in explaining about ragtime, the impact of the music on the changing landscape of New York City, but also New York City changing in this very jagged and dramatic style in these very early years, just before World War I.
So we'd like to insert a quick trigger warning here. This show deals with the themes in small ways and sometimes, but larger ways other times, relating to child abuse, to racial abuse, and also to murder. So if any of these topics are sensitive for you, please take care while listening or skip ahead to our next story. This week I'm talking about the plot of Ragtime. It's an epic story, as Jane has said, and I think it's epic in that it doesn't just follow one story. It's the interlinking of three different families in the early 1900s in the USA and primarily in New York, not exclusively. So there's an upper-class white family. They consist of mother, father, grandfather, little boy, and mother's younger brother. Great character names. I love them. Beautiful. There's a family of Eastern European immigrants, and the father is called Tata, which is sort of like dad or pop or, you know, a name sort of like that, quite generic. And his daughter, who's called Little Girl. And then there's also an African-American family group of a ragtime pianist whose name is Colehouse Walker Jr. And his lover, Sarah. And I use the word lover, might be common law wife, might be girlfriend. I'm not really 100% sure, but...
Well, it changes throughout plot.
This is true. There's a period where they're not connected at all.
Yes.
And not talking. So yes, that's actually valid. So the stories of these three groups are intertwined, and they're also further embellished and built on through the speech and performances of real-life celebrities who were around at the time. So, as Jane said, Henry Ford, J.P. Morgan, Booker T. Washington, Emma Goldman, Harry Houdini, and Evelyn Nesbitt. And Jane sort of explained a little bit about who they are. And you can Google them if you're unfamiliar. I did. I didn't know who some of those people were. Emma Goldman, the activist.
I didn't know Emma Goldman at all. I thought she was actually just a character in the show.
Yeah.
Except she does have a name, which nobody else Jewish in the show has. Booker T. Washington I had heard of, but I didn't know what he did. And I didn't even know what his cultural background.
Yes, same. And J.P. Morgan, I had a vague idea because that's still the name of an investment firm or something. So I assumed there was banking involved there somehow. So they're in this show, the characters in this show, even though they're obviously real people. They were real people. So we start the story with a wealthy white family in an area of New York called New Rochelle. Father is about to head off on an Arctic expedition with the real-life explorer Robert Peary.
As you do.
As you do. Look, and when you're a wealthy white man in New York in the early 1900s, what else is there to do?
Oh, well, you wouldn't want to commune with your family.
No. Arctic adventures calling. Mm. Off you go. And so that's what he's doing. It opens with the family bidding him farewell. Mother is concerned about how she's going to cope without father. I suspect, although it's not explicitly said, but I think that she has followed that path of grow up, get married, have children, do whatever your husband says. She's not been particularly independent in her life. So father sets sail and his ship passes an incoming rag ship, which is bringing Tata and the little girl to Ellis Island, along with a whole heap of other Eastern European immigrants.
That's a beautiful piece of music there, where one family is saying goodbye and the other family is coming in on the boat, and Tata's saying, surely that man is confused. Why would he want to leave America?
I'm coming here to build my dream. Where's he off to? Yeah. Why is he leaving?
Yeah.
Mother's younger brother, he to me seems like a bit of a man who is always searching for purpose in life. He is not spoiling for a fight, but he's always looking for a cause. So he loves Evelyn Nesbitt. He goes to see her perform. He tells her that he loves her, perhaps looking for purpose. And you know how it is when you have no purpose in life. You hook onto a dream of anything and give it a go. He loves her. Of course, she's polite, but doesn't reciprocate. Coming up soon, we have our special guest,
Lucy Truin.
So stay tuned. This section is going to deal briefly with child abuse. So if it's something that you don't want to hear anything about, please skip forward maybe 5 or 10 seconds. Thank you. In New Rochelle, mother and little boy are out in the garden, and mother finds a partially buried, abandoned African-American baby in the garden. The baby is still alive, but obviously you know, being partially buried and abandoned is a dreadful state of things. Police arrive with the baby's mother, who is Sarah. And to save Sarah and the baby from a life of prison, mother says she'll take them in. So they do so, and younger brother is very pleased with his sister's generous action. We then cut to Tata and his little girl. Tata has been selling Silhouette on the Lower East Side, but he's fallen into poverty. Emma Goldman, a real-life Russian writer and activist, comes across him and she speaks with him, but he grows more disillusioned over time with his life. His little girl gets sick. In one of the resources that I looked at when I was writing this up, it said that he's keeping her on a leash to keep her safe. A wealthy man comes along and offers to buy the little girl. Mm. Should that have had a trigger warning? Perhaps. But, oh. I mean, just horrendous. Tata refuses, which is wonderful. And it's really showing that immigrant experience, while being sold the dream, everything's fabulous, may not actually be so in all cases. Houdini is held up as an example of a successful immigrant. And from that, Tata finds the strength to pack up and relocate his life with his little girl.
Speaking of Houdini.
Yes.
I was listening to an interview.
Yes.
With Ahrens and Flaherty. And Lynn Ahrens was explaining how she used those celebrities as a counterpoint to the characters. So Houdini, successful immigrant experience, is held up against Tata.
Right.
Henry Ford is held up against father because they're the same age, or Ford's probably even older, but he's actually doing something modern, but father wants to hold on to the past. So each of them appears as the opposite, or even just held up to for what the character of our story is going through. So it was very interesting to hear why they're there.
That is actually really interesting because it is a funny plot device to have some random celebrities.
Yes, a bit like Forrest Gump.
Wow, a little bit like Forrest Gump indeed. Yeah, less running though. Yes. So we go back to Harlem, and Cole House Walker Jr. is very much fated for his piano playing, but he tells his audience of how he loved and lost Sarah, but that he knows where she is and wants to win her back. Henry Ford drops in, and there's a song about his Model T as Cole House drives off in his own new Model T. Tata and the little girl leave the Lower East Side and head to Boston. They cross paths with mother and little boy, and they have a chat and then carry on with their lives. Meanwhile, Sarah is living in mother's attic, and she sings a plea to her baby, begging for forgiveness for what she did to him. So this is that moving song that Jane was speaking about before. Meanwhile, Cole House is on his way to see her, and while on his way, he's racially harassed by a crew of local firefighters. Noisy. So Cole House isn't initially admitted into mother's house, but he goes back week after week and wins mother, grandfather, and little boy over. While this is happening, father comes home from his Arctic trip to find that his household is topsy-turvy with strangers in his house. But younger brother and mother are both very proud of their actions in taking Sarah in. Eventually, Sarah does come down to meet Cole House, and they reconcile, go on a picnic together, and talk and sing about the dreams that they have for their child.
That would be Wheels of a Dream, which was just performed magnificently by the current cast at the Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York.
Oh, timely. Mm,
yes. Lovely. So it'll be all over your socials the second you write ragtime.
Ragtime. Get ready. Or you know how it is. Just say Thanksgiving Parade and out loud and your phone will find it for you. So yes. Fabulous. All right, Tata has now moved interstate away from New York, and he's quite disillusioned. He's working something like 64 hours a week in a mill. And while this is happening, younger brother goes to a workers' hall meeting. Emma Goldman is speaking there, and she's speaking, trying to incite strikes to reduce those 64-hour working weeks down to 54, which still sounds horrendous, but is a lot better than 64. Younger brother joins the cause, Goldman is arrested for her actions, and Tata gets caught up in the sort of the hullabaloo of the strikes that are going on in Massachusetts. He plans to send his little girl away on a chaperone train, but she's so distraught to leave him that he boards the train with her. He makes a little flip book or movie book to entertain her, and the train conductor likes it and buys it from him. And Tata sees this as a potential money-making opportunity.
I had a flip book when I was a child, and it was about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. So the whole book was about them with lovely photographs in it. But in the corner, of every page, if you flicked it correctly, they did a dance routine.
I'd forgotten that there were some of those books that had the little drawings in the corner.
I've seen them as my children, who are only 10 and 11, they are still around. Yes. But, yeah.
I'd forgotten they exist. Anyway, you know what it is. A flip book. Fantastic. Yeah. So then we cross back to Coalhouse and Sarah, and they're now being racially harassed by those same firefighters, but this time it's much more than just harassment, and the firefighters wreck the car. This happens while a monologue is being delivered by Booker T. Washington, and I think this is probably part of what Jane was saying about those well-known people being placed in as a counterpoint to what's actually happening in the action on stage. There's no legal recourse for Coalhouse to follow through with, at least none that have any success for him. And he then refuses to marry Sarah until he gets justice. Sarah goes to ask a visiting vice presidential candidate for help, but she is mistakenly identified as having a gun and is then beaten to death. So
mistakenly because of the colour of her skin, not because there's anything gun-like about her person.
Yes.
Great.
Yes. She's not walking around with, you know, happy trigger fingers or anything. Someone yells she has a gun quite unfairly and untruly. Yep. Sarah's funeral then ends Act One.
Emotional hit there.
Very much so. Just before you hop out for your champagne and beer nuts or whatever you have. Mother, father, younger brother and Emma Goldman are all watching on, and Coalhouse obviously is absolutely distraught.
And a group of her friends who until now have not been identified, and there's a marvellous female singer called Sarah's Friend who sings this the funeral music, and it is so powerful, and that poor woman deserves to have a name.
Look, there's a lot of people, I feel, in this story who could have done with a name.
Yes, but you know, if you can put it on your CV, I played Sarah's Friend. Great. So unless the person reading the CV actually knows ragtime, they don't know that that means that you have the most impressive voice.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like tree number four when you're just Sarah's Friend.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, so that's the end of Act One. I know. It's exhausting. We're halfway. It's exhausting.
A lot of blood we got. See you in Act Two. This is where you would be hearing the synopsis of Act Two. However, we got so carried away with our special guest that we frankly forgot to record it. If your interest has been piqued by what has come before, may we suggest that you hit the Google, have a look at some of your online videos that we cannot say the name of, and go down the rabbit hole of ragtime. You will enjoy yourself immensely, I'm sure. Dear listener, sometimes our interviews are recorded via a video conferencing link that may account for some sound distortion, or the participant lives in the flight path or is having renovation work done next door. We beg your patience if it doesn't sound tip-top quality.
Listeners, I'd like to introduce you now to our special guest for this week, Lucy Truen. Lucy, thank you so much for joining us. Could you give us a little bit of an introduction into how you met Ragtime and how you came across this show?
Well, thank you for having me. I am always prepared to have a chat about Ragtime. I came across many, many moons ago when I was a teen and I was looking for a song to do for Anna Stepford, and my singing teacher provided me this song from this show called Ragtime, which I had not previously heard anything about, and so I thought I better look into this if I'm interested in forming one of these songs. So I listened to all of the, back then, the CDs, the first CD, there was, it was a two CD show, And so I listened to all of the first act and I was like, wow, this is a big show. And it actually took me probably over a year or two to come across, like to get to the second CD, because it was just such a powerful show to work through. It's been a very long learning journey. And then I guess I was like, once I sort of started understanding the plot and the characters a bit more, I just really wanted to do more of a deep dive. And so came across the book and so just started to read that. And I have just been in love ever since.
Fantastic. So really you came across this show because Jane was suggesting earlier in the podcast recording that the show is largely musicals are always musical based, but this show is really driven by its music, the type of music and that sort of thing. So that's really interesting that that's how you came to it as well.
Can I ask which song it was?
It was Your Daddy's Son.
There's so much in that. It's a hard sing. Yes, you need to know what she's actually talking about because it is the hardest thing that she's been through.
Absolutely.
Extremely emotional. So have you, obviously you have sung the songs, great, but have you ever actually performed as part of a cast that has put the show on?
No, so I was not aware until recently that there were even amateur rights to this show. It is not one that is largely done, and especially in Australia, to the best of my knowledge, only one professional show has been done in Australia. That was done in 2019 in Melbourne, and it only ran for about 2 weeks. So it's not a very widely formed show. So as much as I would love to have the opportunity to be part of this show, I sadly don't think that it will hit the amateur stages anytime soon.
It's not a well-known show like a My Fair Lady or a Lion King that you can whiz all the kids into and fabulous stuff. If you were to appear in the show, which role would be your dream?
I would love to play Mother. I think I really feel like her character is the nucleus of this show that kind of gels all of the other plot lines together. The learning journey that she goes on in the course of the show is, a really interesting journey. I think there's a lot that many people can identify and relate to with the character, and so I think that she's a really interesting character to follow. And if not her, I would love to play Emma Goldman because she's such a strong female character, and, you know, she's obviously set in historical accuracy as well, and so having those kind of real pivotal key characters come in and help the plot move along is, I think, really nice to see in shows.
You're actually not that physically dissimilar to Emma Goldman.
No, I think I have to pass on Emma Goldman.
That's fantastic.
I'll ask you about the book because we have not had time to read such a magnificently long novel. What were the main differences between the book and then Terrence McNally's treatment of the story to make it into a stage show?
I think like in many stage adaptations, obviously there's a truncation of the plot of about all of the characters' journeys and their experiences. So we really only see a snippet of what the characters go through in the stage production. I think they've done a really great job at being able to keep the themes of the book alive through the music and through the character journeys. And I think we've also perhaps softened some of the characters and their own personal values and their own personal choices throughout the show. Characters like Tate and younger brother have quite controversial decisions throughout the book that I think we don't see as much of in the show.
Right.
Yeah, that does make sense. Because you're right, in looking at the synopsis that I've looked at a number of resources, they don't have that kind of powerful drive that I suppose you're talking about them having in the book. So that's really interesting.
There's that device that McNally invented of the characters coming forward and kind of narrating their own story so that the audience can understand a bit more of the action. Do you approve of doing that?
I think it's really interesting. It's one that, I mean, has been done a lot more in modern theatre shows. But I think what's really, really quintessential about this choice is that it follows the narrative. So the opening of the show and the prologue is almost word for word what the first chapter of the book is. And so it's introduced, like all the characters are introduced to us in the exact way that Doctorow wanted them to be introduced to an audience.
Right. I have read that he was very concerned with the way the film adaptation changed his book and people's perception of his work, and so he got very involved from the ground up with the music. Have you seen the film?
Yes, yeah, I actually haven't, no.
Ah, well, what I've heard, because I can't find a copy anywhere, he might have buried it, frankly. Tata has a wife, and it is suggested that she had an affair, and that when we get to America, we just tell everybody she died. Is that in the book?
Yes, yeah, so it's suggested that in order to make ends meet financially, that she permits some would-be unwelcome advances from the landlord and from her employer, who overpays her in order to, in exchange for favours on her behalf. And so because of that decision, that is causes the relationship breakdown between her and Tate.
Oh, that's so sad.
That is really sad.
Maybe they just decided we didn't need that extra level of sad.
Yeah, I feel like the musical was quite sad. We don't need distant sadness as well as immediate sadness. Okay.
Trivial tidbit. In the film, Mrs. Tutter, or Mama, was played by Fran Drescher.
No.
Obviously in a serious acting role.
Wow. Now I really want to see it.
And Mandy Patinkin was Tutter.
Yeah, wow, okay. Mm. Interesting choices there.
Yeah.
Speaking of choices, if you were to cast the show, obviously we know the roles that you would want, but who do you see as your dream cast for each of the main roles?
Now, these can be people who are in different generations from each other.
Living, dead, doesn't matter. What's the dream?
I think this is really tricky because I really love what the original Broadway cast has done. So it's very hard to step out of that mentality. But that being said, when Melbourne did their production, they cast Alexander Lewis as Tate, and I thought he did a really fantastic job. I thought he was outstanding of the cast. And they also had the woman that played, I don't think she has a proper name, but she's cast as Sarah's friend, which was stunning as well. And look, I think it probably is the sort of role that is built for the Cynthia Erivo's world, where you've just got these massive emotional riffs that can just go as far or as, you know, or as close as the talent can allow.
Sorry, I spoke over you before when you said her name. What is that lady's name who played Sarah's friend?
So in the production, it was Ruva Nguyen.
Right.
I hope I'm going to write that. So Cynthia Erivo would be aligned with that kind of role as well. Need the big solid votes for that kind of role.
Yep.
I think it would be really hard to cast someone other than Maren Mazzi as mother, but obviously they've got a new Broadway cast now. Someone suggested to me maybe Kelly O'Hara in that role, which I think could be a really interesting
Had a reunion, big orchestral concert reunion with the original cast, but I think Maren may have already passed away or she was too sick, and they actually asked Kelly O'Hara to come in and sing Mother for them, which she had completely memorised.
I mean, it's a beautiful role and you really need a strong classic voice for that, but also with that, those kinds of being able to scale back on the vibrato, that kind of thing, to be able to add that modern quality to it.
Yes, vocally they're very, they're not similar, but their technique is similar. Kelly O'Hara inherited Lily Vanessi from Maren in that production from 99.
I can provide no information about these dates whatsoever.
Though we've done a Kiss for Kate episode.
I like that you're asking me, but I don't remember from 1 minute to the next what's going on. Are there any other particular people that you would like to see in any of the other roles? So Tata's role, little girl, father, any others?
The only other person I can sort of think of that might be a really fun casting as Evelyn Nesbitt would be someone like Laura Bell Bundy.
Oh, yes.
I think someone that's quite got that really some kind of tone and play off that. It's not really a comedic role, but an upbeat type role. So perhaps someone like her, I think, slot in and do that role really well.
Yeah, she was the girl in Legally Blonde.
Sorry, Lucy, just for a bit of background for you. I don't know anything about anything, and so Jane quite often has to give me pointers about, oh, this person was that or that person.
And yes, we might have a listener who also doesn't know the modern stuff and is of a different generation from us even.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're almost old. And
yeah.
I'm 6 months older than her, I'm allowed. They might know the girl from Legally Blonde, but not know the name, but now they can see why you would call her a good fit for Nesbitt.
Yeah.
I was thinking Chip Zeehan for Tata. That's how I've seen him in my brain. So Chip Zeehan was the first baker in Into the Woods.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And in a playbill for something else in the mid-2000s, it said upcoming for Chip Zeehan in his program bit was a new production of Ragtime. Now, obviously, that never happened. So somebody other than me thought he was a good fit. Or maybe he was just projecting. Maybe he had read the... I made sure that I wasn't imagining it. And and Google said, no, he's never been in any production of Ragtime. So I mentioned this earlier on the podcast. When I was thinking about Cole House, in my head, I kept saying Coleman. So Coleman Domingo kept coming into my head as a possible player of Cole House, which would probably get very confusing at rehearsal. I don't think he has the Barry tenor that you require. He does a nice Nat King Cole, but visually he was in the movie of The Color Purple music as the Horrible House. So he's got acting stripes, but I just don't know if he could sing it. Can anyone sing it like Brian Stokes Mitchell? I don't think so.
It's a particular quality that Cole House has to have to his vocals in terms of that really rich velvety baritone sound. That really, like, you just have to fall in love with his voice, I think. Like, you've got to really understand, like, why Sarah's so attracted to him, why things unfold the way they do, why he has so much charisma, and so much of that in the musical is carried through his vocals and the songs that he sings.
Yes, yeah. It's very stirring.
Right.
He's the kind of voice that sings the American National Anthem the right way. That voice.
Gotcha.
Have you ever heard of, given your fascination with the show, any kind of backstage stories that are funny or controversial or anything?
No, I haven't actually. No, I feel like it's a show that really quite under wraps in terms, like, there's been so few productions of it. You don't really hear a lot of people that have been involved talk too much about their experience with it. My understanding, like, is the only thing that I know is that when the Melbourne Theatre Company chose to put it on, it was quite a controversial choice because it's such heavy content that was the last production they ever did. So they shut down as a company after that. So,
oh, was that the production company?
Yeah, correct, yeah.
Oh.
Wow.
I would have thought it might have just been a commercial bad choice because it's so unknown to Australian audiences. It's also very hard to cast. We don't have nearly the amount of population of talented people from the specific ethnic backgrounds, and you can't in good conscience put people who are not of the same ethnic backgrounds playing these people because it is so much part of the piece. If it's a show it's just people at work, like Pajama Game, doesn't matter what people's backgrounds are, let's have everybody doing everything. But we're particularly talking about race, you need to get that right, and that would probably be where I'd go about doing it here, for example.
And also, I think, like, the themes, like, the undercurrent of, like, American patriotism is probably not something that many other countries identify with. Mm. That is such an important theme for this show, to be able to understand the expectation, the American dream, and what we're expecting to be able to get from that, particularly in that era, and, you know, I guess how things kind of part as the plot goes along. But it is something that doesn't always translate well to other audiences because that knowledge of how that patriotism affects people individually is so important.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. The culture, it's not one of those jolly musicals that even though this show is about the music, it's not a jolly show carried by some snappy tunes you can sing. There's an enormous amount of weight that sits behind it. Yeah.
If you could pick one number to express this show to someone who has no idea, what would you pick?
It would have to be Till We Reach That Day. I think it's the number that comes at the end of first act, and so everyone's kind of halfway through their story, where we've got lots of little inserts from the characters about what's going on them, but also just how the music is written and the crescendos that it brings to the plot, I think, is so important. That kind of just really expresses the tone of what this show is about.
Oh, fabulous. Huh?
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Don't forget to stick around while our special guest reveals the next show behind the door. You're listening to Another Opening, Another Show, a musical theatre podcast.
The next show that we're going to talk about in the next issue of our podcast. Could you do the honours, please, and open that door and let us know?
Your next show is... Company.
Oh, excellent.
Company.
I know just the person to ask to be the guest on that one.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you for listening.
This has been another episode of Another Opening, Another Show, a musical theatre podcast, brought to you by the Gawler Broadcasting Association on Kaurna Land in South Australia. Bye.
Bye.